Ecclesiastes 2, verses 18 to 26. And I am disgusted about this, that I must leave the fruits of all my hard work to others. And who can tell whether my son will be a wise man or fool? And yet all I have will be given to him. How discouraging. So I turned in despair from hard work as the answer to my search for satisfaction. For though I spend my life searching for wisdom, knowledge, and skill, I must leave all of it to someone who hasn't done a day's work in his life. He inherits all my efforts free of charge. This is not only foolish, but unfair. So what does a man get for all his hard work? Days full of sorrow and grief, and restless, bitter nights. It is all utterly ridiculous. So I decided that there is nothing better for a man to do than enjoy his food and drink and his job. Then I realized that even this pleasure is from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy apart from him? For God gives those who please him wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes the wealth away from him and gives it to those who please him. So here, too, we see an example of foolishly chasing the wind.
Luke 12:13-21, the Living Bible version. And someone called from the crowd, "Sir, please tell my brother to divide my father's estate with me." But Jesus replied, "Man, who made me a judge over you to decide such things as that? Beware, don't always be wishing for what you don't have. For real life and real living are not related to how rich we are." Then he gave an illustration. A rich man has a fertile farm that produced fine crops. In fact, his barns were full to overflowing. He couldn't get everything in. He thought about his problem and finally exclaimed, "I know, I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll have room enough. And I'll sit back and say to myself, 'Friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy, wine, woman, and song for you.' But God said to him, 'Fool, you tonight you die. Then who will get it all? Yes, every man is a fool who gets rich on earth, but not in heaven."
Thank you, Bradley and Kyle, for that reading. Another dip into the confusing book that is Ecclesiastes. I hadn't read it in the Living Bible before, Foolishly Chasing After the Wind. This is the second in my series of Or Are They sermons. So this sort of lays out the topics that I'm doing. There are a few of them on the table in the foyer. This week I was traveling, as I mentioned before. I was in Minneapolis, and I was meeting together with other students in my program. We were having formal discussions about theology, about church planting, about spiritual warfare, all sorts of heady academic stuff. But it was good to connect and meet the people that I had been studying with online for a year. But one of the other things that we did was visit churches, like I mentioned before. And when we were visiting churches, then we were also hearing the stories of the sort of things that made that church work. We were talking about their guiding philosophies, the things that they had done well, the things that they had done poorly. So this is one of the churches that we visited. This is the sanctuary. It used to be a Presbyterian church, and the building was sold to another group. And they were a little less traditional, a little less formal, a little less structured. And so on the front wall, where the cross hung up, they hung up a whole bunch of portraits. And we didn't get the story. Were they portraits of people in the church? Were they artwork that people in the church had done? We didn't ask. And the floor of the sanctuary, rather than pews or chairs like we have, was covered in sofas and couches. One of the other students came home, showed some of the pictures to his family, and his 8-year-old son looked up from the picture as if to say, why didn't you tell me there were churches like this? And here he was sitting at a church with pews. But there were different ways of doing church, and it was wonderful to meet with these other leaders to talk about why they were doing things that way. This church emphasized people feeling comfortable, people feeling at home. And there were lots of things they did to convey that feeling. A lot of the time that we spent was at Woodland Hills Church. From time to time, I've talked about Pastor Greg Boyd. He's written a number of books that I've found helpful in my understanding of the Bible. They told us the story of the acquisition of their building. It used to be a Kmart, and it was sitting empty. The Kmart had moved out. Another store had come in and then left, and it was just this ugly building that was starting to wear down. And so this church that he was leading, which was growing, decided that they wanted to buy it, and they had to kind of finagle a whole bunch of things to make it work financially. But one of their oppositions was that because it was owned by the city, then the city council had to approve the sale of the land. And they needed a clear majority, and somebody had already communicated to them that he was going to vote against them getting the land. And that counselor was the owner of a liquor store that was across the road from this building. Because he thought if a whole bunch of Christians move in next door, his business was going to head south. It turns out that Greg Boyd's church isn't a stickler on rules about alcohol, etc., and his business did quite well. But I tend to agree with him that over history, whenever revivals have happened, whenever there have been large movements of people coming to understand Jesus' calling in their life, alcohol sales generally go down. And so it might be a wise caution that he had. But he realized he wasn't losing any business. He realized that he now had good and responsible neighbors. And he started to see the work that this church was doing in the community. And so now, when the church needs a zoning permit, now when they need a building permit to make adjustments to their property, the first advocate they have is that counselor. One of the other things that happened on that property is they also inherited a movie theater. And the movie theater continued to run while they owned the property, and the movie theater paid rent to the church. They just asked that they not show raunchy or gory movies. But gradually, the theater was getting run down. The owner wasn't taking care of it. And so the church wanted to let that owner's lease expire. They would continue running it as a theater, but they would do it as a skills training, a job training thing for people in the community who didn't have opportunities to get into stable employment. It's a fantastic program. I met some of the people who were benefiting from that job skills training. But the owner, the previous owner of the theater, started a bit of a smear campaign that the church was just flexing its muscles. They were going to just use it to show Christian movies. And that was going to make the pastor rich. Well, that was the legacy. The church could respond. They could run their employment program. They could write letters to the editor. But there was a legacy, and that legacy is tough to change. I've been talking a little bit. Sorry, I should have made these pictures a little brighter. I've been talking about the recent CBC TV show called Pure. And very early on this is even in the first episode, the policeman who's investigating a car accident that has connections with some drug smuggling calls down to a police detachment in Texas and asks about the Mexican Mennonites. What do you know about them, he asks. And the American woman who answers the phone says, they're good people. Right, so it felt good to have this validation. But on top of that, she said, hardworking, right? The central virtue, perhaps, of that particular Mennonite community, that they were hardworking. And then she goes on to explain how they have this secret drug smuggling ring and are dangerous people. This is the reputation that they were hoping to avoid, right? The reputation that there were drug smugglers in their midst. They wanted the reputation of being hard workers. This is the community that I grew up in, Mexican Mennonites living in southern Ontario, and there was nothing more honorable to do in the summer than to work on a farm somewhere. And so when I got a job at a tobacco farm, so tobacco and alcohol, I know this is touchy territory, but I got a job at a tobacco farm, and it was really hard. And I thought about quitting a lot on that first day, on other days as well, but especially on that first day. Tobacco farming is so hard. Stompin' Tom Connors wrote a song explicitly talking about how hard it is to work in tobacco. He exaggerated a little bit, and technology has made it a little bit easier. But it was really hard, and I was thinking every belief I picked, I'm going to quit, I'm going to quit, I'm going to quit. But I also knew if I go home and tell my father that I quit my job, then he would be ashamed. Probably not, well, maybe also angry, but he would be ashamed of me. Now, I talk about my parents from time to time, some stories they wouldn't want me to hear. I don't think my dad would be embarrassed to hear that. And I credit it to him as good parenting that he instilled in me. A good work ethic. That's an important thing for a lot of us, for people to know us as good, reliable workers. Now, this, it doesn't seem like it's a theological thing. It seems like it's more of a cultural thing, but within our theological understanding of humility and community and peacefulness, you don't put ourselves in a position to establish pride and reputations for other things. We want to go about our work, our lives, our vocation with humility and sincerity, and that very clearly correlates to working hard. And so as these people in the TV show are talking about the Mennonites, their hard work was a central part of it. But at the center of the Bible, Ecclesiastes is pretty much in the middle, is this random collections of this teacher going through life evaluating where purpose and meaning and joy can be found. And so this is from the Common English, so it's a little bit different than what was read before. But There's a certain kind of hopelessness here. He says, because I will have to leave them all of the things that he worked for. I will have to leave them to someone who comes after me. Right? The translation that we heard before was, I don't know if my son will be wise or foolish. Right? Whether it's your children or somebody else who inherits or buys the land from your estate, you have no control over whether they use the land well, whether they use the house well, whether they decorate it properly, whether they tear it down and build a new one. You can't control that. So all of the fruits of this teacher's work would go for nothing. And it was pointless, he said. And then, talking about all of the struggles of his work, all of their days are pain. All of their work is aggravation. And so we could take a lesson from this that somehow we need to develop succession plans so that the people who come after us will carry on our legacy in consistency with ours. We could take from this that maybe we don't need to work so hard, but that seems to rub against what many of us, I know, practice. And so what would our farmer friends, what would our hardworking friends say about this passage? You'll notice here an emphasis on rest. When you visit a cemetery, especially an older one, you You will see little words like rest in peace or finally at rest. Because in the days where work was all that people had, then death was a relief from that. Death was when we achieved the rest that we so badly needed. Now, you talk to people who are retired for a week, they've gotten all the rest that they need, and they want to do something. So the situation changes. Now, this is a little chart. I didn't zoom in close enough that you could read it. It doesn't really matter. But when you talk about the value of a country, the worth of a country, governments keep those records and statistics, and the central one that they use is called the GDP, the gross domestic product. How productive are we as a country? Right? When we compare how strong our countries are, the productivity is the first number that they quote. So here, the solid line is the gross domestic product of our country, the solid black line there. And then the dotted blue line is... labor productivity, I'm not exactly sure how they measure that. But then the dotted red line on the top at the end there is amount of labor spent. So over the years, we have become less productive and we are working harder. Something's missing there. We were promised a more productive age. I fit somewhere in the middle of the millennial generation and the baby boomers. I grew up with an analog childhood and a digital adulthood. And I remember as a kid, we were told about all of the wonderful things that computers would do to make us more productive. Robots and factories would work way harder than people could. And it would save us time and save us energy. When you look on your cell phone, there's a whole category of apps and programs that you can download in the productivity section. They all cost money, but they are there to make your life more productive. But we aren't. We aren't more productive. So are we getting lazier as a society, or have the rules changed somehow? See, when we look at our personal virtues of hard work and dedication and reliability in the workplace, it doesn't sound very different from the values of the mainstream world. Working hard, getting rich, taking it easy. But something different has to be happening. There has to be something more to it. I found this quote a while ago. And it talks about what it means to be a spiritual leader. And something in it struck a chord for me. It might be a little bit small for some of you, so I'll just read it off of the back wall. This was part of the eulogy of Dostoevsky. He was a Russian writer over 100 years ago. And he wrote books that sort of were images of Christian messages, and it wasn't always entirely clear what the meaning was. But this is what was said at his funeral. The first precondition of being called a spiritual leader is to perceive and feel the falsehood that is prevailing in society, and then to dedicate one's life to a struggle against that falsehood. If one tolerates the falsehood and resigns oneself to it, one can never become a prophet. If one cannot rise above material life, one cannot even become a citizen of the kingdom of the Spirit, far less a leader of others. So at first glance, we might wonder, well, what are the falsehoods? What are the falsehoods? If anything, we are working hard to convince people that something else is going on. We are trying to convince people that there's more than what we see. But here, this this eulogizer has turned it around, and that we as religious people need to challenge our society to see that what we do see is, in fact, a falsehood. That when we evaluate people based on the productivity they generate for our society, when we measure the worth of somebody by their wealth, when we measure the burden that people have on us by the amount of money it costs, by the amount of time we have to spend with them, then we are buying into the ways of the world, and we are not following the pattern of Jesus in our life. So Jesus tells a story. He tells a story that seems familiar to many of us, about a rich man who's worked hard and has accumulated wealth. And looking it over, he wonders what should be done with it. And then he realizes that he doesn't in fact have wealth, he has a limitation. He can't get any richer than what his barns are at already. So he decides he will sell the grain, he will build bigger barns so that he can gather more grain and become even wealthier. This is the story that Jesus tells. It sounded familiar to the people who were hearing it. It sounds familiar to us. We live in a build-up, tear-down, build-up-again society. And so Jesus is telling something that the people will resonate with, and they might not have known what the problem was. That seems like a responsible farmer. That seems like a wise investor and businessman, they might have said. We might have said. But the voice of God comes, not to celebrate, not to reward, not to embrace this man, but to call out his foolishness, to call out the falsehood that he has bought into. That his life will be better with bigger barns and more wealth and more relaxing time. Tonight you will die, he says. Now who will get the things that you have prepared for yourself? Again, Jesus is probably referring back to Ecclesiastes, referring back to this passage that we read before in chapter 2, that we don't know what will happen to our stuff after we go. And so when we put our emphasis on that stuff, and we put our emphasis on getting more stuff, then we are separating ourselves from God's plan. So, what would my story, what would my movie look like this? As I was thinking about this, I thought back to the story of somebody that I knew growing up, and I thought this might make an interesting TV show, at least the way that I would write it. And so I hope maybe you would too. So the first episode starts out, there's an old man. He's 70, he's been working for a long time, he's been volunteering in the community for a long time. And the whole episode, he's going around the town, people are shaking his hand. People are telling him they're looking forward to the celebration that evening. They're thanking him. They're telling him that he has earned and deserved what's coming. Then in the evening, they gather at the community hall. People give speeches. They tell stories. Maybe in the TV show there will be flashbacks to the past of accomplishments that he had on his farm, developments that he made, ways that he was able to strengthen the local economy through his contributions. And also he volunteered as a volunteer firefighter. His contributions never seemed to stop. He could always be relied on for that. And the stories continued and continued. But as the evening wears on, the video shows the wife and it shows the children, and they're less excited than everybody else. Sometimes they even shake their heads. Sometimes they look at each other, knowingly, as though there's a deeper story behind the one that was told at the microphone. And from time to time, they look over at their mother, sadly. Well, the evening comes to a close. The man gets to the microphone. He thanks people. They give him a gift, a retirement gift. They make a plaque and hang it on the wall of the community center. And afterwards, he's shaking hands, and he tells his wife that they're going out to the pub afterwards. And she says, okay. And he goes there. He's with his friends. More stories. And the video shows the mother getting into her vehicle and driving quietly. Back to the bar, they're having fun. They're telling stories. They're laughing. He has a satisfied look on his face that he has done good. He's worked hard. He's earned the celebration. And then the video shows the mother arriving at the homes of one of her children. They hug her. They receive her. And the child goes to the trunk of her car and brings a suitcase and brings it into the room where she will spend the night. The man comes home to the house, and he's looking for his wife. He can't find her. There's a note on the pillow. The end of the first episode. The second episode, we find out what's in the note. That she has worked hard to fulfill his dream. She has made the farm work. She has made time sacrifices so that he could pursue the leisure activities and the volunteer activities he wanted to do. But he had made it clear that he would not pursue her dreams. And so she was moving on to live out those dreams without him. And that she would be in touch with a lawyer, and that he would need to sell the house and the farm and give her half of what they were worth. And so he's devastated. He calls her phone, but she doesn't answer. The children reassure her. And then they tell the stories, the other stories. And so there are flashbacks to the same stories of the first episode, heroic times at the fire department, stories of harvests and yields and missed baseball games and missed ballet recitals and missed choir programs, that when his family needed him, he was not there. And so he can't get a hold of his family. They won't answer his phones. He goes around. He's talking to people. They are all stunned. And so he meets with them again at the bar. And he doesn't know what to do. Third episode, he's working. He's contacting his own lawyer, trying to see if this can be stopped. He's trying to get some communication to her. He sends a message through somebody else who promises to bring her it. And through all of this, he's not sleeping well. He's stressed. He's not eating well. And he has a panic attack. He's in the hospital. The doctor tells him that he hasn't been treating himself well, that he needs to change his diet, that he needs to find ways of relaxing and taking stress out of his life. Fourth episode, we get a little bit of a better picture of what's happening in the lives of the children. That the children have picked up his dedication to hard work. They've benefited from the wealth that he has accumulated and shared with them. But they have also picked up the pattern of hard work. And so now with their mother living with them and the hard work that comes with balancing work and family and schedules, one of the sons misses a baseball game of his sons. And then he starts to realize that perhaps he has become like his father. Cats in the Cradle and all that. And the old man is supposed to be retired, but he keeps showing up, checking in on how the farm work is going. And the young workers sit down with him for the coffee break, making sure that he's not working too hard, making sure that he's not overextending himself. And they tell him their stories of work. They tell him their stories of their girlfriends and wives who don't seem to appreciate all of the work that they do. And then he tells them his story of all of the things that he missed, all of the work that he put in. And now he's starting to realize that perhaps he let things go. And he doesn't want in these young workers the same mistakes to be made. He doesn't want his mistakes to be repeated in their lives. And so in reaching out, his lawyer contacts her lawyer. They start to make plans. They start to do evaluations. They start formal proceedings. And finally, she agrees to sit down with him. And he's angry. He's unrepentant. He's entitled. He still hasn't bought into her story. And he wants to get the kids on his side. He wants to be able to keep the farm and the house and the cars. But they won't answer his calls. They know how he was with their mother. They know how he was their whole lives. And so it wouldn't be a Mennonite, a Christian TV show without a little bit of redemption at the end. And so he comes to terms with what he has done. When faced with the prospect of losing everything, losing all of his relationships and keeping his money, or swallowing his pride and making things work, he concedes. He allows her to pursue her dreams and her hobbies and her interests. And he experiences some kind of redemption. But all through the show, we would see his story, his buying into the success that he had achieved, but in contrast to what he was called to do, in contrast to what his family needed him to be. When we look back over our lives, we will find a time where we are starting to wonder about legacy. How were we remembered? Did we accomplish what we needed to do? And extra hours spent at the office, at the factory, in the fields, won't amount to anything. What we need to be doing is deepening relationships, deepening our interdependency with other people. When we surround ourselves with people who only need money from us, we won't get deep relationships. When we surround ourselves with people who can benefit us, whether it's through giving, whether it's through teaching, whether it's through their experiences being different than ours, then we can grow and become deeper and better people. Then we can understand more of what is happening in this world and how we can be a part of what God is calling us to be. So let us not find our salvation and our redemption in accumulating wealth, in evaluating our productivity. Let us find our worth and value in the relationships that we form and living out the vocation that God has given us and separating ourselves from the ways that the world values us and values others.